Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Benjamin Moser, author of Why This World, a biography of Clarice Lispector. His long-standing affection for the Brazilian writer and his stewardship of her literary legacy. And I'll have a review of Roxane Gay's Hunger, a memoir of my body. Benjamin Moser is the author of Why This World, a biography of Clarice Lispector, the life story of the brilliant and beautiful writer, born in the Ukraine, but Brazilian to the core, one of the world's most prolific and underestimated women writers. Ben grew up in Houston, but now lives in the Netherlands, and he's visiting New Orleans to talk about his work on Lispector and his work in progress, a biography of Susan Sontag. Ben Moser, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you are such a man on a mission when it comes to this writer, aren't you?
It's been almost 15 years since I actually started trying to get her work into the world. And when I first started, I didn't know what to do because promoting a dead Brazilian lady that nobody can read in English and from English in other countries, I didn't know where to begin. I was really young. I was like 24, 25 when I started. And I wrote Why This World, which took me 5 years. And I hoped that that book would open a door to understanding her and to knowing who she was. And it did exactly what I hoped it would do, which was make possible the retranslations of her work and the reinsertion of her at the level that she deserves to be on, which is among the great modern writers.
And I love that you fell in love with her work when you were only 19.
Isn't that funny?
It is.
Sometimes adolescent passions are not a good idea. And sometimes they last all your life. And
sometimes they set your course.
And I didn't know why I had this attraction to her until I went to Brazil. And when I first went to Brazil, everybody who loves her really loves her. It's not just like you admire a writer or you think she's interesting. It's a real love. And as I've gone on all these years, that love has only deepened.
I was interested. I was going to ask you what language you read her in originally, and it was Portuguese, her language.
I read her in Portuguese because she was hardly translated in English. I was at Brown University, and my professor, who's now a professor at Tulane, Chris Dunn, had us read little short works of Brazilian literature in our Portuguese class. And I'd only happened into Portuguese because I had failed out of Chinese, which was my original idea for studying in college. And I started doing Portuguese just because I needed to do a language. And there she was. And there she still is. It's so funny. It's like someone you meet in a bar or something. And sometimes it's a one-night stand and you forget about it. And sometimes it's your whole life.
Yes.
And it's a very happy marriage between me and her. She doesn't know about it, but
that might
make
it. Yeah.
But as the longer I've gone on with her, the more my admiration and affection and has deepened, and the more I've learned from her and never stopped. It's really like any great subject in the arts. The longer you go on with it, the deeper you go into it, the more it gives you back.
I'm very curious to know, given your experience with her in both languages, how do you prefer to read her now? Do you prefer English? Do you prefer Portuguese?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I mean, all of her that is now available in English has come through me. Either as translator or as editor. And I've edited these things to within an inch of their life. I mean, draft after draft after draft. It's very difficult to get her right. I'm very proud of the English. I feel like I have this investment in it. I found a voice for her that probably other people might not have chosen in English. And I've kept it really consistent throughout all the translations, which is a lot harder to do than it sounds like, especially when someone ranges as widely as she does. But her voice, you always know it's her. If you're a Brazilian reader and you pick up one sentence of her, there's no second choice. I mean, everyone would know exactly who it was.
I know. She writes the best first sentences.
It's amazing.
In those short stories.
It's
you know,
amazing.
It's just, ah,
yeah.
You're there the minute you read that sentence.
She was a real genius. And this is something that is almost impossible to explain to people. But I just finished writing this book about Susan Sontag. Susan Sontag, who was a very brilliant woman, but was not a genius. She knew it too. She knew that she didn't have that thing that really only comes along maybe once in a generation. You know, you have a great pianist or a great painter or someone who, for whatever reason, comes into this world to do something that nobody else can do. And Clarice Lispector was one of those people. And it's not something you can learn. It's not something you can study. But it is something that often kills the person who has it.
Yes.
But to those of us who are able to admire that talent in whatever field it is, it gives us a richness and a hope and a beauty that is so often lacking in our regular day-to-day lives.
So for the uninitiated, talk a little bit about the arc of her life, which was so extraordinary.
Yeah, it's lucky as a biographer, because when I wrote Why This World, I didn't really know that much about her. I just knew she was a brilliant genius. And I didn't know really where she came from. And sometimes, you know, you can be from the Garden District and just live in New Orleans your whole life and go to CVS and buy shaving cream and nothing really happens and you can be a great writer. But with her, those are not the lives that are fun to write about and that are interesting. Clarice was born in Ukraine, in Western Ukraine, in 1920 as a Jewish refugee. Her family was already fleeing. She was conceived as an answer to a horrible, horrible thing that happened to her mother and to hundreds of thousands of other Jewish women, which was a rape. This was a punitive thing that they did to Jewish women, and it's a very common thing in war. And Clarice is conceived not by the rape, but in a magical attempt to cure the result of the rape, which was syphilis, which was something that nobody could cure then because she was still a few years away from penicillin. Now you get a shot, you keep walking. But then it was a death sentence.
No one knew that.
No one knew that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of shame around sexual violence, as there still is. But imagine in a rural community in a pre-modern society. But the family miraculously managed to reach Brazil in 1922 when she was a little more than a year old. And she grew up watching her mother die and thinking that it was her fault because she had been conceived to cure her mother. And she failed because she needed penicillin. She didn't need a baby. So she made it to Brazil. And it was fascinating to meet. When you do biographical research, you realize that these things that seem like 100,000 years ago, there's always people who remember things. I'm sure here in New Orleans, you could find people who might not remember slavery themselves, but they would have definitely heard about it from their grandparents. I met old ladies who remember the Russian Revolution perfectly. They remembered when the Bolsheviks showed up in their town. And they also remembered how beautiful she was even as a baby. And it's a funny thing to think about that she had it. Whatever it is, she had it. And people were absolutely dazzled by her from the time that she was really a little girl. She was so beautiful and she was so brilliant. And by the time her mother dies when she's 9, she has already started telling stories. And the stories are magical. They're about curing her mother. And when she fails, these stories fail, and she therefore also fails. She still has this way of telling these magical stories that goes on and on throughout her whole life. It's a way to reach God. It's a way to reach some kind of transcendental truth that she's not really sure what she is looking for, and she's not going to find it either. But she is obliged, in a religious sense, to seek it anyway. And she grows up to be, as an old man told me, and it's very fun to meet old men who met her in 1940.
Oh, I bet.
They, you know, they can be 95 years old and in a wheelchair, and you can see them when they talk about her, all the wrinkles and all the old, you know, the drippy eyes and everything, it falls away, and you can see them as 17-year-old boys getting their first glimpse of this magnificent, monumental woman. And they become young again, talking about her. And she started writing these books that no one had ever seen anything like this in her language. Portuguese was very much about certain aspects of Brazilian life. It was kind of used, Brazilian literature is often used as a way to try to understand this new country. And she was interested in understanding the soul and understanding things like love and death and God, and not shying away from them with a courage that you can't really imagine, because she was rejected and rejected and rejected. She spent many years abroad, including in this country, as a diplomat's wife.
I know the notion of her serving finger sandwiches and pouring tea.
She put rose petals in the finger bowls.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hilarious. And that's why she finally liberated herself from that. And she comes back to Brazil at a time where, in 1959, where really a middle-class person would never leave their husband. Divorce was not even legal. You could get officially separated. But it took a real courage. I mean, this is a country where women couldn't eat at restaurants by themselves. That was considered something for hookers. No middle-class woman would like go get a slice of pizza. And so she did it. And she came back to her country with her two children. And she started creating the great last phase of her work, which are now seen as the greatest monuments of Brazilian literature in the 20th century, and make her not just admired, but really, really loved by people. People feel that she understands them, that she understands them better than they themselves understand themselves. And it just keeps growing. I was just in Rio last year, and there's a huge, it's not huge, but it's at a very, very prominent part of the city on the beach, a statue of Clarice and her dog. And I went there and just sat there with my iPhone taking pictures of people taking pictures. They come all day long to have their picture taken with her. Like, there's this desire, even though she's made out of bronze, there's this desire to sort of sit with her and talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very funny combination that she could be this very normal, in some ways, housewife, at the same time as she's this terrifyingly intimidating writer and artist.
You know what I kept thinking about when I first read her work? I kept thinking about Anne Sexton and the awful rowing toward God. You know, that intensity and that sense of I alone in my little boat on this quest. You know, that power of being drawn to that
and
experience.
Of being drawn under.
You yes, know,
Anne
that
Sexton,
too.
Sylvia Plath, even Elizabeth Bishop to a certain degree. A lot of these women writers in the 20th century, this is something I discovered when I was working on the introduction to the Complete Stories. Women writers often either become alcoholics or they kill themselves.
Right.
And this is something that I didn't really know. I mean, you know that some of them do, but that sort of seems like something that a crazy artist would do. You know, it seems like, oh, they're all nutty and they're drinking and stuff. But actually for women, it's different, because the kind of indifference and the kind of contempt really that women writers faced and still do face is absolutely terrifying. And I realized at a certain point that Clarice Lispector was actually the first woman, the first middle-class woman who wrote about middle-class women, which was not a subject. Now it's every book is about middle-class women. But, you know, in 1950 in Brazil, that wasn't a subject. You know, housewife picking up her kids or going to the grocery store, that was not what you wrote literature
right.
about. And she did that, and she went all the way through her life, and she died of natural causes. She died pretty young. She was only 56.
57. Oh, sorry.
Well, it was a day before her 57th birthday. So you're both right.
No.
But she finished her life. She finished her work. She wasn't interrupted.
And you talk about how she didn't, I don't know if respect is the right word, but how she felt about Virginia Woolf.
Yeah. She said the terrible duty is to go to the end.
I love that.
It's a fabulous, scary, creepy sentence, but she said, I don't forgive Virginia Woolf for having killed herself.
And that's right. She didn't forgive her.
She didn't forgive her. And if you look at her face, you see that woman, you wouldn't want to get on her bad side, you know, even if you're Virginia Woolf. And she was, and so that's why, even though she doesn't write explicitly feminist, political activist kind of things, the example of her for women writers in Brazil, and now increasingly as we're publishing her all over the world, the responses to her from a lot of younger women who are looking for some kind of example. Sontag is a similar figure. You know, people really admire the strength and the figure of Susan Sontag. But Clarice is becoming more and more this inspirational figure. She never knew that. I mean, she died with a sort of artsy public in a few neighborhoods in Rio and Sao Paulo. And, you know, in the way that so many great artists do. But now the love for her and the admiration for her just is growing every day.
Well, I wish you'd read this section from the introduction to the stories, because I love this description.
Yeah, so this is about, this is the introduction I wrote called Glamour and Grammar, which are two words that are actually have the same etymology. The word glamour comes from the word grammar. And I loved this. I thought when I found this in this old book about Sir Walter Scott, I thought I have to use this. It's about how she managed to be both a great artist and a normal middle-class woman. This accomplishment lies in the second woman she conjures. If Clarice Lispector was a great artist, she was also a middle-class wife and mother. If the portrait of the extraordinary artist is fascinating, so is the portrait of the ordinary housewife whose life is the subject of this book. As the artist matures, the housewife, too, grows older. When Clarice is a defiant adolescent filled with a sense of her own potential, artistic, intellectual, sexual, so are the girls in her stories. When, in her own life, marriage and motherhood take the place of precocious childhood, her characters grow up, too. When her marriage fails, when her children leave, these departures appear in her stories. When Clarice, once so gloriously beautiful, sees her body dirtied with wrinkles and fat, her characters see the same decline in theirs. And when she confronts the final unraveling of age and sickness and death, they are there beside her. This is a record of a woman's entire life, written over a woman's entire life. As such, it seems to be the first such total record written in any country. This sweeping claim requires qualifications. A wife and a mother, a bourgeois, Western, heterosexual woman's life. A woman who is not interrupted. A woman who did not start writing late, or stop for marriage or children, or succumb to drugs or suicide. A woman who, like so many male writers, began in her teens and carried on to the end. A woman who, in demographic respects, was exactly like most of her readers.
I love that. It's so lovely. And it's such a generous act. I mean, I love the story of your your chase to write this biography and putting all this stuff on your American Express card.
Oh, my God. Just, I think I'm still paying for it.
Well, but so worth it. I mean,
yeah.
And now you are a steward of her work in that best possible sense, I think.
It's been really such a rewarding experience to see her come into English. The Complete Stories, which is an omnibus of all of her stories, 88 stories from the time she was a teenager to the unfinished things she left when she died, five of the novels. And then we're publishing the remaining four novels in the next couple of years. But I also go all around the world talking about her, and it's really fun. I mean, I was in Greece in December, and The Hour of the Star, which is her final novel that nobody cared about when it came out, and it sold a few copies, and it's now the number three best-selling title on the Greek bestseller lists, which I thought was kind of hilarious. We just published it in Dutch, and I just got this thing yesterday from Belgium that says, you know, the Low Countries are experiencing an explosion of Clarice mania.
Uh-huh.
And so you kind of publish them wherever you can, and wherever I go, I like to talk about her. And it is nice to be a steward because, you know, people need it, even the people that you think don't need it. You know, here we are in New Orleans, so you can think about somebody like Tennessee Williams or you know, John Kennedy Toole or all the great Louisiana writers. Well, if people don't put on Streetcar Named Desire, nobody's going to know about it, and life moves fast. There's always a new book, and there's another people, class of kids in 10th grade English who might not know about him. They might not ever read Blanche DuBois, you know. So it's a fun literature, and I think culture in general has a lot of room for ambassadors and for people to hit the pavement and get people excited about books or painting or music. Or,
well, as a reader, I am grateful. So,
well, as a worker, I'm grateful that you're reading it.
We've been talking with Benjamin Moser, who's the author of Why This World, A Biography of Clarice Lispector. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Clarice, lay down your mind. It's there, just hard to find. Follow me as we wind away.
Here's a book I've been reading and thinking about lately. In Hunger, A Memoir of My Body, Roxane Gay, writer of provocative fiction and brilliant cultural commentary, offers up a story of almost unbearable pain and searing honesty. She describes how she began to alter her body after she was raped by a young man she thought she loved and a group of his friends. She was 12 years old. She began to eat. Her hunger for love, for acceptance, for self-immolation, her need to take up space in the world, almost insatiable. Hers was an unruly body, she writes, in a society that values control and judges women by appearance. She chronicles her education at Exeter and Yale, where she found a home in the theater department, the dangerous years of her 20s when she lost herself in food and dead-end jobs, working for a phone sex line, pursuing bad relationships with men and women. Along the way, there are stops at fat camp, weight loss clinics, and finally, her need and her desire to become a writer set her on the path to where she is now. Her personal story is compelling enough, to be sure, the way being a person of size has informed and limited her way of being in the world. But Roxane Gay, shrewd observer that she is, sets her own life against the larger cultural context. What do shows like The Biggest Loser, which she calls an unholy union of capitalism and the weight loss industrial complex, really mean? What about Oprah's highly publicized struggle with weight, which preoccupies her many followers? Here's a passage I particularly like. In yet another commercial, Oprah somberly says, "Inside every overweight woman is a woman she knows she can be." This is a popular notion, the idea that the fat among us are carrying a thin woman inside. Each time I see this particular commercial, I think, I ate that thin woman, and she was delicious but unsatisfying. And then there's this. Gay writes, "What does it say about our culture that the desire for weight loss is considered a default feature of womanhood?" This is not a triumphant book. Gay warns us at the outset that this is not one of those stories with before and after images of her standing in one leg of her previous pants. But all those who love memoirs will see a victory here in this powerful reckoning with the hard reality of a crime, a body, a life. If we are honest with ourselves, we'll acknowledge our own hunger for love, for success, most of all for acceptance from both self and others. And it's never-ending. Roxane Gay, in this unflinchingly honest story, reveals not only the truth of a body, but the truth of a woman's heart. New Orleanians will have a chance to hear Roxane Gay in conversation with New Orleans writer Maurice Ruffin, Wednesday, July 12th at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center. Tickets are available at Octavia Books. Expect the unexpected. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Bill Lofelm discusses and signs The Devil's Muse, his new Maureen Coughlan novel, Tuesday, July 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Young adult author Sarah Milnowski, author of I See London, I See France, Jody Lynn Anderson, author of Midnight at the Electric, Adele Griffin, author of Be True to Me, and Morgan Matson, author of The Unexpected Everything, discuss and sign their work Tuesday, July 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gwendolyn Tompkins discusses Danny Barker's A Life in Jazz, Tuesday, July 11th at 6:30 at Algiers Regional Library. Historian Sherry Tucker presents a lecture, More to the Storyville, Listening for Early New Orleans Jazz Women, Wednesday, July 12th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collections Williams Research Center. The Garden District Bookshop Book Group discusses Commonwealth by Ann Patchett, Wednesday, July 12th at 6:15 at Garden District Bookshop. Memoirist Roxane Gay, author of Hunger, A Memoir of My Body, appears Wednesday, July 12th at 7 for a reading and interview with Maurice Ruffin. The event has a new venue, the Uptown Jewish Community Center, and more tickets are now available at Octavia Books. The Maple Street Bookshop Book Club, now known as Maple Street at Ladder Library Book Club, discusses Yuri Herrera's Kingdom Cons, Thursday, July 13th at 6 at Ladder Library. Laura Dragon, author of the young adult novel Hurricane Boy, presents a panel of authors who've contributed scary campfire stories to the Bayou Boogeyman Presents, Hoodoo and Voodoo. That's Thursday, July 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The authors who will appear include Cheryl Mathis, Josephine Schlegel, Virginia Howard, Gary Alipio, and Patricia Heffler. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Embers by Sandra Marai, Saturday, July 15th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Historian Alicia Long leads a discussion and introduces a screening of Pretty Baby, Saturday, July 15th at 1 at the Historic New Orleans Collections Williams Research Center. Several branch libraries will be hosting finale parties for the Children's Summer Reading Program this weekend. Friday, July 14th from 1 to 3, East New Orleans Regional will host a party. Saturday, July 15th from 1 to 3 at Algiers Regional. Sunday, July 16th from 1 to 3 at Ladder Library. Events are intended for children 5 to 13. There will be snacks, crafts, and giveaways. Poet Emma Pearson reads from and signs her new book, New Orleans, City of My Heart, Sunday, July 16th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. And there's a lot going on at the East Baton Rouge Public Library for readers. The Science Fiction Book Club discusses Firewatch by Connie Willis, Tuesday, July 18th at 6 at the Main Library. And the Fiction Writers Workshop meets Tuesday, July 18th at 7 at the Greenwell Springs Regional Library. Yuri Herrera reads from and signs Kingdom Cons, Wednesday, July 19th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Ellen Gilchrist reads from and signs Something Like the Truth, Out of My Later Years, Thursday, July 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. All through July, the search to find the popular children's book character Waldo is on again at Uptown area businesses. Get a passport at Octavia Books and find Waldo in his red and white striped shirt with his dog Woof on vacation. He'll be at Uptown businesses like Toast, Angelique, Dat Dog, Hanson Snow Blitz, The Magic Box, Britannia Theater, Scriptura, and many others. Get your passport stamped, and the search ends with a party with prizes Sunday, July 30th at 2 at Octavia Books. The deadline for submissions to the 2017 Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence is coming up August 15th. This award honors rising African American authors of fiction while recognizing Louisianan Ernest Gaines' many contributions to the literary world. Submissions may be novels or short story collections published in 2017 or galleys of 2017 publications. The winner will be announced in November, will receive a $10,000 award, and be honored at a ceremony in January in Baton Rouge. For more information, visit ErnestJGainesAward.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.